You're listening to Boston Strongcast, a place where we talk all things powerlifting, strength, and the occasional scientific nerd session. I'm your host, Kevin Kahn, the owner of Precision Powerlifting Systems, strength coach and competitive powerlifter in the USAPL. Thanks for tuning in, and let's get stronger together.
Hey guys, this is Kevin Kahn with Boston Strongcast. I am joined today with Dr. Jeremy Lonecki. Did I say that right?
Lenecki,
I was close. Out of Old Miss University. So I wanted to have you on. I had you posted a discussion with another research group recently, and I shared both studies and like kind of gave my my feedback on from what I've seen as a powerlifting coach over the course of the last few years now. And the internet blew up. Like I couldn't believe the amount of almost like a religious type of feedback where people disagreed extremely hard with my stance. There's no way they even read the articles. Like these were within minutes of me posting this. Like my direct messages were blowing up. So I found it very interesting, and I had come to the same kind of conclusion from observing my lifters over time. Like as a powerlifting coach, all I give a shit about is their one rep max. Sure. I want to know that they're getting stronger. I don't give a shit how they look like if they're not getting stronger. So like I had come to this, like over time, it's like Western periodization just seems to have like a lot of flaws. And like one of them would be, you know, you get after a meet, you do these high rep sets, you get this hypertrophy block. And then 4 weeks later, you've somehow accumulated more muscle mass than now you can realize in a strength block. And your research was kind of some of the first research that I saw that just started to ask questions. And it wasn't like you were giving answers. It's let's just be a little bit more measured in this approach. And I want to hear your story on how you got to that point.
Sure. Well, again, thanks for having me on. I think that I totally can believe the amount of messages that you received on people, you know, maybe being quite critical of anyone kind of questioning whether or not muscle hypertrophy might be playing a role with strength. And I think a lot of that has to do with it's so ingrained in how we even teach it. So I totally understand where a lot of those people are coming from. But I think from my perspective, I was of course very similar to them because I was taught that, you know, when individuals start lifting weights and they get stronger, the first part of that is neural adaptations, and then muscle growth plays a large contributory role as you progress through resistance training. And that's kind of the paradigm that a lot of people work under, and it's the one that I worked under for a long time. But I think it's the same thing that you observed. There just came a point where a lot of things weren't lining up, and they weren't lining up quite a few times in a row. So, you know, we started to kind of ask the question, and it always helps when you have, I have really good students in my lab right now, as well as in the past. And we just start kind of discussing, is it possible that these two things with respect to resistance training aren't actually causative? So is that a possibility? And that forced us to go and look at those early studies. And we started to ask the question of, well, why do people even believe this idea in the first place? And if you look early on in the resistance training literature, there's a lot of skepticism with respect to, is muscle hypertrophy even doing anything useful with respect to strength? And some of that had to do with that they weren't able to measure muscle size very well. So that's part of the skepticism. But if you look at the timeline, at around the 1970s, towards the end of that, the story began to be told a very different way. It went from being kind of a question to being more of a matter of fact statement that without question, muscle growth plays a role with respect to strength. But when you look at those studies, one of them isn't the one that's most cited, didn't even measure muscle growth. And that's the one that a lot of people point to as evidence for neural first followed by hypertrophy. But even the ones that do, what they note is that a group that lifts weights gets, they see an increase in muscle size, and they also see an increase in strength. And because they were able to measure that muscle size, then that must have been contributing something. So obviously that's not very strong evidence. You'd want to know what strength would look like had that muscle growth not occurred. So early on, there's already not a lot of good evidence for this claim. And I think what happened is that you start to kind of tell the same story over and over and over again, to where it becomes, and this was the case for me, you almost don't even question it anymore. You almost assume that, well, there must be some pretty good evidence behind it because a lot of people think it. And it's just not the case. A lot of people believe it to be true because of the baseline relationships. In other words, if we took 100 people and we measured their muscle size and we measured their muscle strength, on average, people who are bigger are going to be stronger. And on average, those who are smaller are going to be weaker. But that's a very different question than what happens when you start lifting weights and you get stronger. Those are two separate things. And they should be discussed as two separate things. And I think that's where a lot of people kind of have a disconnect.
There was one of my colleagues shared this term with me the other day. He said someone that he was talking to called it a shared ontology. So basically, you know, like you were saying, it becomes a belief that increases in muscle size contribute to increases in muscle strength, and nobody ever questions it. In your paper, and so the title of this paper for everybody listening is "Exercise Induced Changes in Muscle Size Do Not Contribute to Exercise Induced Changes in Muscle Strength." You actually listed a bunch in the historical context section. You listed a bunch of studies from 1939 on that were questioning whether hypertrophy played a contributory role towards strength. And then all of a sudden, like you said, in the 70s, it seems that narrative had shifted and everybody kind of stopped questioning it. Yeah. Do you think this is just a matter of our technology, our current day technology and our current understanding of basically like human physiology just kind of only allowed us to measure certain things? So we were able to measure something. We got this information, patted ourselves on the back and just kind of passed this information down. I don't understand where the not questioning it came from in the 70s. It does kind of seem to correlate with periodization research when that started to kind of make its way into more popularity in the lifting world.
I guess I could see it. And I could see it because when we think about, well, what's ultimately producing force? It's muscle. So it seems intuitive that if you would have more of that, that somehow that would relate to at least a greater potential for strength. It's just, that's a big leap to make when there's not evidence for it. But I get the underlying reason, the underlying theory behind it. But I think that you can see a lot of this when you start looking at some of the resistance training literature that's come out in the past 10 years, where you start looking at, and this is where it started to happen for us, because we do a lot of low load alternative forms of resistance exercise. And when you look at low load exercise, we can produce really large changes in muscle size comparable to that of traditional high load exercise. But most of the time, the strength is not even remotely close. So you have to start asking how much of that muscle growth is actually contributing to strength. And when you start looking at, you know, and I think you highlighted this with your athletes, you care about the getting a big 1RM and the big 3. And that's because there's a big specificity component to strength. And everybody knows this. So from my perspective, and I think it's your perspective as well, any mechanism that we're looking to try to explain strength should probably try and reflect somehow that specificity component versus just an overall gross change in muscle mass. I think any change, whether that's neurological or even at the fiber level, it should try and explain the specificity component that we see all the time.
So the process that I went through with all of this, so I had a very famous Russian coach for 3 years, and it was all about, it was a lot of sub-maximal volume. Mm-hmm. So I kind of was mimicking the way that he was giving my program to me and how I was training. I was doing this with my lifters, and we would get stronger. And I think what people miss the mark at is it's not an all or nothing thing.
Sure.
Right? We're looking for what will increase performance the most. So I'm doing all of this, you know, in quotation marks, optimal volumes. And I would, like, with my lifters, I was tracking tonnage, what percent we were doing of competition lifts, number of lifts, average intensities, acute chronic work ratio. I had all of this data. So in my head, I was like, all right, if I have all of this data, there's no way that I can be wrong when putting all of this stuff together. And what I saw is over time is, yeah, we would get better, but there'd be a lot of times where we just wouldn't. And yeah. I had the data to show that I can follow these simple rules of periodization and progressive overload. I'm doing everything that they're saying to do, but in a lot of cases, I'm not getting the same results. So I started, and this wasn't just like all of a sudden I flipped a switch and we are where we are today.
Sure.
But over the course of the last 2 years or so, year and a half, I kind of threw how I measure, like I don't measure total tonnage or volume. Like those are arbitrary numbers that mean nothing outside of context. So we'll do 1 to 2, what I call hard sets. So maybe, you know, you might be able to get a rep or two out of that set. Each day we come in, and of course we have conversations. If something's nagging, we'll try to alter positions. We'll try to train through it. Certain times, other times we take a lighter day because that's what the universe is telling us to do, in so many words. What I've seen from doing this is way better results. The results aren't as all over the place. We had 26 people compete in April and 26 total PRs. There's no way. We might have had 20 if I was doing it the other way, which I would have been pumped about. And you kind of disregard those other six as error.
Sure.
When the error is really like those general principles are generally true until you apply it down into the individual level. Yeah. And I think, and this is where people kind of get hung up on me a little bit, because we might do the same things, but it's a matter of having a certain frame of mind where if you believe hypertrophy to be true, that if I increase muscle strength, I mean, if I increase muscle size, that strength will follow in suit. What do you do when it doesn't work? You're now stuck in this box banging your head up against a wall because what you believe to be true has now been proven to not be true, but now you have nowhere to turn. So, you know, and I think in Kuhn's book about scientific revolutions, he explains, and this was kind of my guessing with some of the historical context, if you don't offer an alternative paradigm, your thought process can kind of fall away. So if it's not muscle size that's leading to strength. You in the article alluded to this a few minutes ago that it's more of a skill set thing. Am I right in suggesting?
Yeah, it seems like the greatest changes in strength happen. You know, I mean, if your outcome is the 1RM in a particular lift, the best way to increase that is to train in that lift close to the 1RM. So from my perspective, I just haven't seen any experimental evidence to suggest that that's ever limited by the inability to gain muscle hypertrophy or to gain muscle mass rather. And you know, that it points to a neurological component. In other words, you have either alterations in the brain, spinal cord, or the motor neuron. But it could also be local level changes at the muscle that occur independent of changes in muscle size. But all of those are just ideas as well. So it's not to say that I have any evidence pointing to those mechanisms in fact play a role. But I think that most people would probably suggest that neural certainly probably is doing something.
And I would imagine this research to actually try to get a solid answer to this question would be nearly impossible because you'd have to somehow separate the brain from the body. Am I wrong in thinking that?
Yeah, it's very tough because you can, there's techniques that you can use, but then you're not testing voluntary activation. and the actual lift that you're trying to do. So there's ways to try and get at that. And we're throwing around ideas in our lab right now. We have another, I have a student, Zach Bell, who's going to start his dissertation, at the end of this next coming fall. So we're still working on trying to get at ways where we can try and separate some of those components. But yeah, you're right. It's a very difficult question on both sides. So, you know, I actually just had a discussion with the lead author of the other point counterpoint, Chris Tabor. And, you know, I think the one thing that we both agree on is that this is, I think one, we're both trying to get at the answer. And two, it's just a very difficult question to answer. Especially when you get, you know, if you want to, you know, if you're on my position and you say, okay, it's not muscle size or it doesn't seem to be, then what is it? Then that's a whole nother host of things to try and work through.
Right. And, you know, I like to think optimistically that at some point maybe we'll get some answers to this. But I think where, especially, you know, for a sport like powerlifting, it's a grassroots sport that basically didn't really get popular until, you know, maybe 6 or 7 years ago. So the majority of the people within this sport are educated from internet blogs, yeah, and, you know, these beliefs that get kind of passed down from generation to generation, and a lack of experience. And I think it's not even just a lack of experience within the sport, but a lack of experience on the earth, because a lot of them are young. Like when I was in my early 20s, I knew everything too. So I kind of like,
sure,
get some of these same aspects. But like one of the things that I started to change within my own thinking was just embracing uncertainty. Like it's just having a more measured approach. Like you're not saying that it doesn't matter. And I think people interpret it that it doesn't matter. You're saying we don't know. The research suggests that it's not necessary. It is not contributory, and we need to change it to, we need to ask another question, do research to try to answer that question, and hopefully that opens up another question for future research.
Yeah, but I think,
no, go ahead.
Let's talk about what we know, right? So if you want to get strong, if you want to get a big deadlift, right, and you want, and a big deadlift is, you know, with respect to a 1RM or a big squat or the big bench, then you get that by doing those movements. You don't get that by doing, you don't, if your goal is to set a big squat PR, then you'd want to spend a lot of your time squatting close to that 1RM and versus doing a leg press. Not to say that one may not confer just a little bit, but to get a big 1RM in the lift, you need to be doing that in that particular lift. So you have to account for both the specificity of the load as well as the movement. So we know that, and I don't think anybody disagrees with that. So what can explain that specificity component? Is it muscle mass? Well, when we look at that literature, what we find is that when people exercise, oftentimes they do get bigger muscles, and they oftentimes, of course, get stronger. But that can't tell you the importance of muscle mass for strength unless you create a situation where you see you have a group that doesn't increase muscle mass and you see what impact that has on strength. And that's something that we've been doing a lot in our lab. And it's not easy to do, and it has its own limitations. But we have one group that trains traditionally. They see an increase in muscle size and they see an increase in strength. When we look at the next group that was designed to minimize muscle growth, we see no change, but we see the same change in muscle strength, indicating that the other group that had muscle growth, it didn't seem to be conferring any advantage. So, and that's true in a lot of other situations where it doesn't appear to be contributing anything extra. So I think that leads you to believe like, well, is there any good evidence to believe that muscle growth is contributing in any way to that specificity of strength? It doesn't seem to be. And, you know, and that's, you know, as we said earlier, then why are we even trying to connect these two dots? Because the tradition tells us to, not because of experimental evidence. And, you know, I think that's the bigger picture, is we keep trying to go, okay, well, what percentage of muscle mass does contribute? But you're already assuming that it does. And I think that's very, very dangerous when there's absolutely no reason to believe that the change in one causes the change in the other. So, you know, and we put that forward in the rebuttal, and the statement was, let's just pretend for a moment that the current paradigm is that changes in muscle size do not contribute at all to changes in muscle strength. Would any of the evidence provided by the other authors, would that convince you otherwise? Would the correlations at baseline, would that be convincing? I doubt it. Would the fact that one correlates with the other when both of them were designed to increase, is that convincing? I doubt it. Does the fact that some of these associations with skin folds are a little bit, correlate across time and rugby players, is that good evidence for you? I doubt any of that would be, unless you already thought it to be true in the first place. So right. I think that that's the biggest issue, is that anytime we're entering into this discussion, oftentimes you're entering into the discussion with someone who already thinks it matters. So it's hard to go anywhere there when you're already assuming that it's a mechanism, and despite zero experimental evidence for that.
Yeah. And I remember, so when I first started getting into like the strength sports, it was always, you know, you're looking at a, let's say a variation of one of the lifts, and the thinking was to strengthen a weak muscle within the lift, like in a very like reductionist view of what we're actually doing. And, you know, you might do a variation and then there'll be some like accessory work, which is more like, let's say like bodybuilding stuff, on that, you know, in quotations, that weaker muscle. So I'd asked a question once, and the answer to the question was, you know, my question was, do these accessories actually transfer over to strengthen my one rep max? Because it doesn't make sense to me that doing 20 band pull-aparts is all of a sudden going to make me bench more. So the answer to the question was, well, if you just did the accessory work without the competition lifts and the competition lift variations, it wouldn't transfer over. So then in my head, I'm like, well, then how do you know they freaking work if we're not just doing those? And like, if it's reliant upon the actual skilled movement to transfer over, you don't know if it works. And like, that's where the belief, it's just like, it's embedded in these, things. And like, I'm not at the point where I'm comfortable enough just like removing all accessories. I think there's some benefit to training in different angles. And like, I now leave it open-ended for my lifters so that they develop a little self-efficacy. They do the things that they want so that there's buy-in, and like there's other aspects that we can draw from it for now. But I wholeheartedly just kind of believe that if I took them out, it wouldn't freaking matter at the end of the day. Like maybe for some... Yeah, we're not even good at reducing injury either. So I'm not even comfortable saying that it might even.
Yeah. And I think and I'll just put it out there that I'm not a coach. So I would never tell, you know, a coach how to deal with their athletes, or an athlete, you know, to not listen to their coach or whatever. But I do think it's, you know, I'm offering the perspective of, is this really doing as much as you think it is? Because some people could argue, and I think it'd be a good argument of, well, what does it actually matter? Does it hurt? Does it really matter if I'm doing a little bit of hypertrophy work? If it doesn't affect strength, does it, you know, it's kind of like Pascal's wager with respect to lifting weights. But I think you could say that, it might matter. It might matter if you're spending more time doing this hypertrophy type workout rather than working on your skill. Because it's possible that if you do a little bit too much of that, you're spending more time recovering from something that's not maybe actually contributing to your maximal strength. So instead of recovering from what you're actually trying to get good at, you're recovering from something that's adding nothing to it. So I think those are all things to consider. But no, I definitely agree with what you're saying.
Like, you know, one of the like rules I give them is like, I don't want them, like you're saying, I don't want them stiff and sore the next day because they balled out on accessory lifts that we can't squat, bench, or deadlift to what we would have been capable of if they just scaled that back a little bit. Because that just doesn't make sense to me whatsoever. Are you familiar with John Kiley's work at all?
A little bit. I'm a little bit of his position on periodization and general adaptation syndrome.
Yeah, I want to hear your take on that part of it, like the critiques of Western periodization and the general adaptation syndrome, and where it probably is more wrong than.
Yeah, we've published on both of those concepts as well. Periodization with respect to changes in muscle size and strength doesn't appear to do anything additive. And I've seen nothing to suggest otherwise. I think sometimes what you'll see with strength, depending on what's being compared, sometimes you will see an advantage to linear periodization, but a lot of that is probably explained by specificity. And as what we were referring to earlier, and what I mean by that is, a lot of times when you see those differences in strength is when that one group has gone from training, 10 reps to 6 reps, whereas the other group is still training at 10 reps. So, you're getting closer to the 1RM in one group and staying where you were in the other. So I think part of that, if there is a benefit in that respect, I don't think it's the periodization per se. I think it's just, you're taking advantage of specificity at the end of that training block, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And more than likely the novelty of a new stimulus too, right?
Potentially. Yeah. And I think the variation component I'm interested in, and I don't know how much of the variation is doing anything physiologic. It could be more so just a psychological kind of, you're doing something a little bit different. You're a little bit more motivated to try and improve. I just have a hard time with trying to think of a physiologic reason why varying something would matter for muscle hypertrophy. I could maybe see something for strength with the specificity component there. But I think that the periodization model itself, the idea of planning out this kind of training in advance, I think a lot of that makes sense if you're competing in like team sports and things like that. I think when we think about powerlifting, I don't think it's nearly that important or as important. Obviously you still want to plan to make sure you're ready for the meet, but I don't know how much you have to manage, because the actual training in the gym is all the training that you're doing. So you don't have to also go practice on the field or anything like that. So I don't find periodization to be that compelling as a necessity for training for size or training for strength. With that said, if that's something that people enjoy and that keeps them, they like to have really complex programming that keeps them motivated to stay in the gym and that works well for them, then by all means do that. I just don't think it's that complicated to train for muscle size and strength. With respect to the general adaptation syndrome, I think that was an interesting concept published by Hans Selye. And I think a lot of the disconnect that comes from our group, as well as others, is coming from the how they've changed what the general adaptation syndrome means. If you look at Hans Selye's early work, it seems to me to be evident that that has nothing to do with normal resistance exercise or normal exercise. Because that syndrome makes a lot of claims. And the first one would be, if you give a stimulus, then you have this alarm phase. And the stimulus that they're giving is toxic doses of drugs or exercise. So they're forcing animals to exercise to exhaustion, which is extreme stress for them. Not anything remotely close to what happens in normal exercise. Or they're dosing them with drugs. So what they find is that when they dose an animal with drugs, there's an alarm phase, and the alarm phase is basically where you're almost have a, they're really focusing on the thymus gland. So it's essentially shrinking. And then you have a phase of resistance where it starts to build back up. And then if you give that stimulus enough times, you exhaust the organ or the organism, and it dies. So that's the general adaptation syndrome. And it also suggests that when you adapt to that exercise, when you adapt to that a drug or that exhaustive exercise, they have this term called adaptation energy. And what it suggests is that when you adapt to, say, formaldehyde, which is one of the drugs, then you lose the ability to adapt to adrenaline. So in other words, if I've stimulated you with formaldehyde for 5 days, and then I give you a dose of adrenaline, all those animals are going to die. And that's because they said that you adapted to formaldehyde, but not to a different stimulus. So I don't know what that has to do with exercise. And I think that some people will say, well, nobody's saying that people are dying or that you're getting, thymus involution or adrenal hyperplasia. Nobody's saying that's happening. But what people are saying is that when you first start exercising, that you get this or that or that. But my point is that we have to discuss the general adaptation syndrome for what it actually is. And what it actually says is that no matter the stress, it doesn't matter if it's exercise, doesn't matter what it is, you all respond in a general the same way. And that if you give it enough, you'll exhaust the organ and it will die. That's not what happens. There's not exercising in the gym is not the same stress response as injecting atropine. Those are two different stimuli and they don't respond the same way. And I don't know of anyone who actually believes that. So my perspective is that the general adaptation syndrome was a nice idea, but I just don't know how it has any relevance with resistance exercise or exercise at all. I don't think exercise in humans results in a general adaptation syndrome.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And I think we take the general adaptation syndrome and we put a time component on it, and then we assume that all of these things happen within X amount of weeks, however we're writing our programs. I have a question about fatigue. And I don't know if you're equipped to answer this, but I'd like your thoughts. Anyways, do you think it's even possible for... for some reason in the strength sports, overtraining becomes a concept that gets like, we're scared of fatigue lifting weights, but like I played soccer through college. I did the MMA thing for over 10 years after, and nobody ever was really worried about fatigue. Like we trained hard frequently, and it seems like we may have these interoceptive like feedback loops that just kind of let us know that we're tired and we need to shut things down before we can even get to that exhaustion. I'm wondering what your thoughts on overtraining and maybe that exhaustion type piece would be for like lifting weights.
Yeah. I think it's obviously very possible to overtrain. But to your point, I think you really have to try. And I don't think it happens very often unless you're just, doing crazy amount of things every single day with no recovery whatsoever. That's often a claim made by periodization, is that it's important to try and avoid, that overtraining phase. And I think a lot of that can just be avoided by, I think as you said earlier, kind of going a little bit by how you're feeling that day. Do you need to take a lighter day instead of just forcing something that's not there that day? I think when we look at the papers that have demonstrated overtraining, it took about 2 weeks. And those are some classic papers by, I believe, Andy Fry. I mean, they're really interesting papers where they demonstrate that it is possible to overtrain. But I think the important piece there is that they were trying to do that. So they were having people come in every day for 2 straight weeks, and it took 2 straight weeks in order to see even something that remotely looked like overtraining, where they were training them maximally every single day, repeatedly. And they were able to induce it, but I think it's important to point out that was the whole purpose of that study. The whole purpose was to create a model to try and induce overtraining. So I think it's a mistake to take that and say, see, you have to be careful training hard, because if you do that, there's possibility of overtraining. Yeah, that's possible, but you'd have to be doing something that even remotely looked similar to that study. And I don't know that anybody, I've never met anyone who does that, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense.
And that's not a criticism of Andy Frye's papers. Those papers are awesome. The point of those papers was to create a model of overtraining so they could study it. But I don't think they ever meant it to be taken as reason why you wouldn't want to train a certain way.
I know in a lot of research studies, they've actually had a hard time getting overtraining and showing some type of like CNS effects post-training. I remember reading one, I forget who the author was, but it showed that there was almost full recovery after 20 minutes. So they were actually theorizing that when they were testing the whatever CNS markers that they were testing for, that they were perhaps just testing too late and the person had already recovered.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
In those Frye papers, they trained like compound lifts 7 days a week. Do you remember kind of how it was set up?
I think they were doing like 10 maximal 1RMs, I think in a squat. And I think they were doing some other kind of anaerobic testing. So it was a lot. It's amazing to me that, you know, I mean, to me, that tells you the human body is kind of amazing that they even survived that, because they did that for 14 days. So I think that's in itself pretty incredible, but yeah, it was a lot. And I don't think that's what anybody even remotely is doing, especially 14 days in a row.
First of all, those subjects in that research study that stuck it out are pretty badass for sticking something out like that.
No doubt about that.
I would have quit day one. No, go ahead.
But I think we get a lot of this for, we do a lot of our protocols are just to muscle failure and, or to task failure, really. And I think a lot of people have concerns about doing that. But I mean, I've never seen anything negative happen from doing that. I mean, we've done that in young people. We've done that, in older people. We've had older men and women come in, train to failure 3 or 4 days a week for, you know, 8 straight weeks, and nothing happened, but they got stronger. And I guess you could argue that had they done that for the next couple of years, maybe it's different, but I just can't imagine that's the case. I think that, if they were doing that every single day, with no rest whatsoever, then yeah, of course, you know, that's going to be a problem no matter what you're doing. But I think the body's pretty good at recovering from, people are exercising maybe 1 or 2 hours a day. I think they can recover from that pretty well, especially once you're in a trained state.
I wrote this article on my blog that got me a lot of heat too, because I'm okay with missing reps, like for that reason. Like, yeah. You know, if you're looking at it from a skill acquisition perspective, you need that sensory feedback to be strong to alter perceptual inference so that you actually make some changes. So sometimes you're going to miss reps. Like, I put them in positions that are tough, and sometimes it's technique wise. Sometimes they put too much weight on the bar. And everybody was like, well, it's dangerous to miss reps. But if somebody is, you know, as long as proper load management is taken into consideration and somebody is physically and psychologically capable of getting underneath that weight, I don't understand. People miss reps at competitions all the time, and nobody's getting hurt, but it's like this like innate belief that we have that if you, you know, train to failure, it will screw your recovery for, you know, however long people, you know, with the whole CNS burnout thing, and like you're at greater risk of injury. But if safety pins are up, you have spots, you're physically and psychologically ready to take these weights. I don't understand your CNS. Obviously in that Frye study, it took a lot to get that CNS to react. Like, I don't understand where people's thinking is. And like, I'm not trying to change anybody's mind, because you know how we do it. They take those 1 to 2 hard sets, and they're near maximal sets from, I kind of set it up. So they'll take, I use a lot of variations. So they'll take, you know, 5 reps week 1 to get used to an exercise, 4 reps you're still kind of getting used to. And then weeks after that, 3, 2, 1, we start loading up that variation, and hopefully they're getting close to what they're capable of hitting in their competition lift in these variations. I haven't seen any problems. And to be honest, we have less issues now than we had before by doing this.
Yeah.
I think there's a resiliency, and I'm not sure if it's all physical. I think there's some psychological resiliency. Like, we expect something like delayed onset muscle soreness to happen, and we're like, oh, we're sore from training, but we know we'll be okay in a couple of days, and then they're okay. But like now, I think with some of these like cultural beliefs where, oh, if I train so hard, my CNS is fried, like people come in moping around. It's like, oh, I train really hard on Monday, so, you know, it's Wednesday, Thursday now, my training's definitely going to be decreased. We don't know that.
Yeah. And I guess it would depend on, you know, what you were doing. Right. And I think that if you're, it goes back to kind of the original discussion, if you're doing a lot of things that maybe aren't contributing to your ultimate goal of getting stronger in a lift, like you're doing a bunch of volume work in an effort to increase muscle size, then maybe you are doing some things that maybe are putting you back a bit. But no, I think I tend to agree with you. I could see the psychological component if you, and I know this isn't what you're suggesting, but where, you know, if you misload someone repeatedly in training, you just totally kill their psyche, just ruin their confidence. But I could see that, but that's not something that you're suggesting.
No, absolutely not. And like, I'm okay with missed reps. I'm not telling them to miss reps all the time. Yeah. Like if they miss the occasional rep, fine. Yeah. Like you're training hard, you're going to miss sometimes. And I think what I was seeing with a lot of my lifters before was the exact opposite. They got scared to miss reps. So they'd be a little conservative on attempts or be really nervous going out for a third attempt at a competition where, you know, failure is part of every sport. In some sports, you fail more than you actually succeed, like a sport like baseball. Yep. So, you know, there's a fine line there that, you know, miss because the weight's heavy, don't miss because you're scared of missing is kind of like one of our things. And I think it just builds that, like that confidence, which is extremely important for those performance markers.
Right.
I have another colleague. She's a professor at a local college here, and she studied under a professor at UConn, William Kramer, who he was an endocrinologist by trade, so to speak. She had this, this was a really interesting thing that was said to her by him. He actually believes that strength doesn't happen incrementally, that it just kind of builds like a storm in the background. And then all of a sudden kind of just like shows itself at the surface. So with a lot of these periodization studies, like your one rep max, and like I've seen this with my lifters, so I keep track of objective performance markers, and they'll kind of be similar, right? Like small spikes, small valley, small spikes, small valley, and then all of a sudden something huge happens. Do you think that's a reasonable scenario?
I don't know. That's an interesting perspective. I'm trying to think back to kind of my training, and I don't know. I guess I would agree that it's probably not just I'm going to get 1 pound stronger next week and then 1 pound stronger and 1 pound. I could see that, but I just wonder if part of that's just explained by you have to have multiple things working in sync, and then when they do, then you're able to see maybe that 5 pound change. So I don't know. That's an interesting point.
Yeah. I mean, it really just like got me thinking about a lot of things. Like, you know, we put in, like, just to tie this back into like the periodization model, like super compensation, like we believe that if we stress the lifter to a certain extent and then we let that stress dissipate, all of a sudden we see some like remarkably new performance. And that's not something I've ever witnessed. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. We basically just train up until the meet. So the week of the meet, we'll have a lighter week. So some of that stuff can go away. Mm-hmm. But that's about it. We'll take a heavy-ish bench on the Monday, you know, 6 days before, and, you know, maybe like 85% for a single on a squat and deadlift and go compete. Like I don't change anything. And our results are actually better by just, you know, like taking like a sports mindset into this sport. You know, we practiced up until games, you know, a couple of days off before, and went for it. And I think it just, it makes a lot more sense to me. I do want to, you know, backtrack a little bit. This is the last question I actually have on my list. Cause I was for a period of time always searching for this like optimal volume, for everyone. And I know a lot of, programs that we use that are very popular Like your daily undulated periodization. There's linear models that you basically just kind of throw volume at volume at volume. I kind of just want to hear your take on that aspect of it in terms of hypertrophy and strength.
Yeah, I think the I think the volume thing is, especially when we study it and the how it's used in research studies where they try to match volume by using numerical values. I think there's several issues with that, but I think if we look at the muscle hypertrophy literature, I think there's some indication that there needs to be some sort of volume. I don't think it needs to be a tremendous amount, but there needs to be some degree of volume in order to make a muscle get bigger. And I think a lot of times, if you're looking at some of the literature, 1 to 2 sets oftentimes is more than enough. But I think to be safe, if you do 3 to 4 sets to failure, or 3 to 4 sets with a moderate amount of weight, you're going to be able to stimulate muscle growth. Muscle growth is something that happens, across a wide range of loading patterns. But if you do 3 to 4 sets, that's going to be more than enough volume. Now with muscle strength, I don't know how important that volume actually is, because I think so much of it is still based on the idea of specificity. So I don't have a good feel for how important or how much more doing 2 or 3 sets is than doing 1 set close to your max. I think when we look at some of our studies where we have those two different research designs where one's designed to minimize growth, one's designed to maximize it. One limitation with that is the exercise load is not matched. But if we look at, but both of them are lifting relatively heavy. One's close to the 1RM, one's about, 8 reps away, especially at the last set. But what we can see is, one group is training around 40 repetitions per session. The other group trains a total of 4, but the strength change is equivalent. So it's not only that it's not different, it's the same, statistically equivalent, which is very difficult to do. So that leads me to believe that exercise volume is important for, to some degree, for muscle growth, but less important for muscle strength, because it's kind of a weird thing to discuss anyway, because if you do 1 rep, well, you already have some volume. So it becomes even a difficult concept to discuss, because people will go, well, you can't say volume's not important because doing 1 repetition is volume. But I think that my long, convoluted answer, there is some pretty good data to suggest that doing a little bit more volume is important for growth, but I've seen nothing to suggest that's true with strength. Assuming that you're training, close to that, or spending some time training at or near that 1RM.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I've seen. So my lifters, so I have them view volume as just practice of a skill. Yeah. So if they take that, 1 to 2 hard sets or whatever, and it's like, this feels like shit, I want to work on this aspect of the lift or whatever, I'll let them do back offs. But in most cases, I make sure I tell them that it's not necessary to actually do these, because all I'm thinking of, if this is not going to go to them getting stronger and I'm going to dip into that recovery well a little bit more, there's probably a greater cost associated with doing it than not doing it. Like, I'd rather just pack it up for the day and hit it hard the next day in the gym.
Yeah. I think if we look at it as a number of sets, if you do 1 set, or if you do 4 sets versus 1 set, then that 4 sets is probably going to give you oftentimes more muscle growth, but not more muscle strength. But if you do 8 sets, it probably isn't that different than 4 sets with muscle growth. But again, muscle strength is still the same, whether you're doing 1 set, 3 set, 4 sets, 5 sets, 8 sets. Most of the time that doesn't ever change, but it might sometimes with muscle growth. And again, I guess that highlights that these variables seem to be disconnected so many times.
Right. And I mean, that's, that's where it's extremely confusing, I guess. And, you know, I respect the work that you're doing, like trying to answer those hard questions and not just kind of, it's easy, I think, to cave into cultural beliefs with some of this stuff. Same reason why, like John Kiley, I love reading his articles. Just being a critical thinker and being open-minded and being skeptical to, you know, as a coach, we need to observe things a little bit more. And I think in a lot of cases, like when something doesn't work, and like, this is what really irritates me at times. If you use like a classical periodization model, right, you believe volume to be true. It's not, you'll then blame the lifter for something like, oh, it's your nutrition. It's your, and that's just, I'm a firm believer that coach athlete relationship is one of the most, if not the most important factor in this like entire scenario. And that's just not a good way for that relationship to go, where there becomes finger pointing when things that we don't know to be true turn out to not be true.
Yeah. And I think you're right. I think skepticism and being critical is very important, but I think it's also important from the other side. So I think when someone like myself comes out and says, hey, you know what? I don't think that this change is that important for this other change. I think it's good to, for other people to go, wait a second, what? You know, this is, especially if it's been believed for so long. I think skepticism on both sides is always very good, assuming that it's working towards the ultimate goal of figuring it out.
Oh, 100%. And I think I wish college would teach effective communication more.
Come to the University of Mississippi. We got it going on here.
Yeah, that's good to hear. And I think there'll be a cultural shift with that stuff. And like, you know, change isn't easy and it doesn't just happen overnight. You know, so there's always going to be, especially when you go against cultural beliefs, there's always going to be some type of backlash, at least for, you know, for somebody like us in a competitive environment. We'll see you on the platform and we'll let the results speak for themselves.
I would just add that, you know, with that muscle growth, because when people look at studies, I would just ask them they have to be able to ask themselves, is this study capable of answering the following question? Had there not been muscle growth, what impact would that have on strength? Are we able to know that from this research study? And if we aren't able to know that, then that study can't really be used as evidence that one is important for the other, which is often how it's used.
Yeah. And that's another skill too, that I think, you know, reading and understanding research, I didn't learn how to do that until my first semester of grad school. Yeah. And I was lost, and I, you know, and I feel that's a skill set that I should have had earlier on. It became very difficult for me at the beginning of grad school, trying to like navigate those waters.
It's difficult, no doubt. And I was in the same boat, and to be honest, I get a little bit better at it every year. So I'm still getting better at reading them myself, as I continue on.
And like, I try to encourage everybody, like, even if you don't understand them, like just read them. Cause it does over time, like it starts to make a little bit more sense. And then like, I'll go back and reread the ones that I probably didn't fully understand then, or even as my perspectives change, I'll go back and reread them and kind of see where I stand on some of the other things.
And it's interesting too, as you brought up Thomas Kuhn's book, because I think, you know, he was early on was reading some of these old concepts and was like, how could they possibly think this? You know, and it's like they were working under a different paradigm. That's the only way it made sense.
That book I found very interesting. Almost like mind blowing at times. Yeah. That like, you know, this was the world that they lived in at this current time, and what they believed to be true. Like, this is going to happen to us at some point, you know, like a few decades later, people are going to look back and be like, yo, these people don't know what the fuck they're talking about over here. And like, you know, but that's progress. And, I find those concepts, and like, I love the philosophy of science stuff. Like I'm like hooked on some of that stuff and how like culture ties into it. And, I find a lot of that stuff extremely interesting.
Yeah. There's a lot of good ideas in that book.
Yeah, absolutely. Are there places on the internet where people can find your stuff? I know I saw you post some of your studies to Instagram.
I'm on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Twitter is probably the best place to communicate. My handle's the same for Twitter or Instagram. It's just at JP Lenicke, so LoeNNeke. And that's where I post almost all of our stuff.
Awesome. Are most of your articles open access?
No, most of them are not. That's a great concept if you have money to do it. Unfortunately most of them are not, but you know, oftentimes if we can get in contact with each other, sometimes we can, share some of those articles.
Yeah. Sci-Hub for the win. Yeah. Dr. Lenicke, thank you very much for coming on. I appreciate the discussion. There's a lot of good stuff in here. I'm probably gonna have to go back and re-listen to it.
No, thanks for having me on. And I, like I said earlier, and just to reiterate, I have just a great team of students currently as well as in the past. So I think that, you know, being in that environment, having those great discussions, so have really helped hone a lot of these ideas. And so I just want to reiterate, these are kind of our ideas. So it's not something that I just came up with by myself. So I have really good, you know, really strong, intelligent students who all contribute to these ideas. So, and they've done a lot of the research in our lab. So, just to like to acknowledge them as well.
That's awesome. If I was a undergrad student again, I'd be looking into Ole Miss.
Yeah. Thank you.
Got it. Guys, you can follow me on Instagram. It's KWCan. Our team, Precision Powerlifting Systems. Stay strong, Boston.